So I'm here from Boston University School of Public Health, and instead of speaking about large data today, I'll be speaking about some very focused examples on how people interpret and respond to genetic information. So this paper by Dickinson came out in 2008, more than 10 years ago. And it's a woman who was a 25-year-old who submitted her DNA to three different companies, 23andMe, Navigenics, and DecodeMe. You might note that DecodeMe and Navigenics no longer exist, but 23andMe does, as well as some other companies like this. And she says, "I was so hyped up about getting my DNA analyzed, I didn't really think about the consequences of what I would learn." And maybe that's common for a 25-year-old. That didn't seem to work. So over the last 15 years, we have learned of thousands of genetic variants associated with disease traits, at least 60 for coronary artery disease, 30 for stroke, more than 100 for type 2 diabetes, and I should mention these numbers are changing all the time, by the way. 30 for Alzheimer's disease, 150 for cognitive functioning, more than 100 for lipids, more than 100 for body mass index, and more than 700 for height. And there, this is just a few examples of the numerous genetic variants that we've found to be associated with disease traits. So this thing doesn't seem to be working. So does this information help or add up to a healthy life? Does it really help us figure this out? Well, we don't really know the function of most of these genetic variants. We don't even know which variants are functional most of the time because they're correlated with one another. But there are some interesting glimmers of success. There was a 14-year-old male in the hospital a few years ago in an unexplained coma. He was sequenced and a rare bacteria was found and he was cured shortly thereafter. CRISPR is a new cutting-edge technology that there's a lot of hype about being able to alter someone's DNA and cure them or prevent a disease. For multiple gene diseases, there are summary genetic risk scores or polygenic risk scores that David's going to talk about here in a few minutes. And that gives us a better idea of the accumulated risk for disease beyond the traditional risk factors, but not much knowledge about treatment. So do you want to know about your genes? Nancy Wexler is a famous researcher in Huntington's disease. She's frequently spoken about her desire not to know what her genetic, whether she has the Huntington gene or not. Both her mother and actually three uncles were affected with the disease and she'd watched them decline. It's a very disabling disease in middle ages. There's no prevention, there's no cure, and she had decided not to have children. And so why should she know? She wanted to live her life without knowing. Why do people want to know, on the other hand? Well, the most common reason are childbearing reasons, and this has been historically where genetic counselors have come in and worked on genetic risk. You may want to know when a treatment exists, that what your genetic risk is. Or you may want to explain an existing condition, or many people just want to know their ancestry. I think a lot of the requests to 23andMe are to find out ancestry. Some people are just simply curious. So, in the mid-90s, there was a lot of discussion about returning genetic information to people, and Part of this revolved around Alzheimer's disease in particular. And McConnell and colleagues back in the late 90s made this statement: more research is needed on how individuals and families understand complex probabilistic genetic information and on the implications of living one's life at risk of Alzheimer's disease. AD stands for Alzheimer's disease. We and some others had actually published pictures, figures like this, which showed that risk of Alzheimer's disease in African Americans who have a first-degree relative with Alzheimer's disease, and also this comparable risk among their spouses. And we also had the same thing for whites in the U.S., both those with first-degree relatives and those with the spouses who had no relatives. And you can see that there's considerable risk among people who have a first-degree relative of Alzheimer's disease. The probably one of the major genes for Alzheimer's disease, there are some autosomal dominant genes that put someone at risk of Alzheimer's disease, usually occurring at quite young ages, 40s or 50s, which is young for Alzheimer's. But the most common one for older, for late onset Alzheimer's, is the APOE gene. And you'll note here that about the four alleles, what puts people at higher risk of Alzheimer's disease, and that consists of about 22% of the population. A little unclear about the two fours. So there's a lot of concern about this APOE gene because it's fairly common. So in the mid-90s, there were a number of studies which said that we should not do risk assessment for Alzheimer's disease with APOE. First of all, the APOE genotype is not a highly accurate marker, and what they meant by that is that you can have a 4 allele but never develop Alzheimer's. So it wasn't fully penetrant. There was no treatment or prevention if you did have the gene. And there was a lot of concern, continues to be concern about discrimination or psychological harm. And five consensus reports came out in the 1990s recommending against providing genetic information about the APOE gene and the risk of Alzheimer's. So I'm going to talk largely about the risk evaluation and education for Alzheimer's disease study, otherwise known as the REVEAL study. So the main goal of this study is to learn what happens to those who receive their genetic risk from APOE. So it consists of a series of randomized clinical trials to evaluate how people respond to genetic information, and I'll talk about three of those trials. In the first trial, which started around 2000, we decided to provide Alzheimer's disease risk information to two groups, two randomized groups. One group would receive information based on age and sex alone and the fact that they were first-degree relatives. And the second would provide the same risk information, but also add in information about their APOE genotype and how that increased their risk. And both of these groups were followed for 1 year. So the general outline for the study was to enroll people and then to have a group educational session talking about Alzheimer's disease. These were all first-degree relatives of a person with Alzheimer's. And to talk a little bit about the APOE genotype and its risk also. And then there was a blood draw and a randomization at that point to these two groups. One with just about family history, and one with family history and APOE genotype. And then people were followed for a year. So the educational session involved a 90-minute semi-scripted group session. It was led by a genetic counselor. They're highly experienced in this type of communication. And they described the limitations of APOE testing, the absence of a medical benefit, and the format of communication for the risk. And this is sort of what happened in terms of the study. 301 people participated in a phone interview to see if they'd be interested in participating in the study. 218 went on and participated in the group educational session. 183 went on to private counseling and a blood draw, and 162 were randomized. And you'll note that we actually randomized 2-1 in terms of the two groups, so that the group that received the information with APOE genotype was twice the size of the group that did not. And then we had follow-up at 6 weeks, 6 months, and 12 months. So a major hurdle in this study was how to communicate, how to calculate the risk estimates, and then how to communicate the risk estimates. And this was my primary role, actually, in this study. I was actually somewhat nervous about providing this risk information, worried that people might take it too seriously, because I was drawing on data from two different sources. One was we had those age-specific cumulative risk curves based on survival analysis, as I showed before. And then we also had another data set which gave us the increased odds ratios for APOE associations at specific ages. And so I had to put this information together from two different data sources. So this first one is the risk we're seeing for these different groups. These are the spouses, these are the men, and these are the women. Women are generally at higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. These are in first degree, these two are first degree relatives. These are the spouses, so which represented the general population in this instance. And these are the curves, the age-specific curves for the increased odds of Alzheimer's for different APOE genotypes, relative to the 3-3 genotype, which is the most common genotype in the population. And this one's for men. You can see that the 4-4 are at much higher risk, and the 3-4s are at some are higher risk as well. For women, this is the same set of curves for women. So how do we go about calculating the risk given certain APOE genotypes? The goal was to actually calculate the posterior odds, and then from that, we could calculate a posterior probability of risk at a certain age. And so we used the prior odds of Alzheimer's disease without knowledge of APOE, and then we brought in the knowledge of APOE. That's what this is basically saying. So this is really talking about, we took the posterior odds to calculate a posterior probability of disease, and that based on the prior odds and the relative risk. Note that the relative risk was the risk of APOE genotype in those with AD at by age A relative to those who did not develop AD by age A. And so that was one of the problems, was we don't really have that relative risk. So we approximated it by, first of all, assuming as epidemiologist. Who asked me if I was an epidemiologist? Epidemiologists for rare diseases assume frequently that relative risk are approximately equal to odds ratios, so we did that. And we switched the roles of APOE and age in our equations, because we know that the odds ratio for exposure given A versus not A is the same as the odds ratio for the event A given exposure versus not exposure. And using that, we were then able to come up with these curves. This is the one for the risk for men in the no APOE disclosure arm. This is what we showed them, actually. So we showed them the risk what we call the general population, really the spouses, and the risk given the fact that they were a first-degree relative. And we only gave them the risk up to age 85 because we felt that our information beyond that was didn't have very many numbers, so we didn't feel very confident about those. And this is the risk in men, in a man. So this first curve that I just showed, this is what we would show to those men in the no disclosure arm. This is what we'd show to men in the disclosure arm, disclosing ApoE. And in this case, this is what we would show to a man who had ApoE genotype 3-4. So if they were different, if they were 4-4 genotype, it would be a different curve, but similar. Or if they were 2-3, it would be, again, a similar curve. So that's actually how we gave them the information. We showed them these risk curves, told them their risk by age 85. We could even say, well, you're age 50. What is your risk given that you're age 50 now? So what happens to those who learn their genetic risk in this study? So our biggest concern in this study really was safety. It was a safety trial, and we were concerned that people might go out and jump off a bridge or something. They learned their ApoE genotype was 3-4 or 4-4. And so one of our primary measures was anxiety, and this is what we came up with. So at 6 weeks, they're pretty similar. The non-disclosure group, which is the blue, had a little bit less anxiety than the disclosure group, but they're basically together. And you can see at 12 months, they're literally right on top of each other. And all scores, more importantly, or as importantly, were below the cutoff for concern, which was 10. So these are all around 4 or 5, 10 ways way up there. If we considered the ApoE4 group, this is the purple group, and the E4 negative group, which is the green group, again, you're seeing that they're now a little bit of separation at 6 weeks, but by a year's time, actually no difference. And again, all of these differences between these groups are well below the cutoff of 10. Another measure we looked at is depression, CESD. And again, we found basically no difference between the group that we gave the genetic information to versus the group that we did not give genetic information to. And all of these scores, as with anxiety, were well below a cutoff for clinical concern of 16. And when we broke down by the E4 positive, E4 negative, again, you're not really seeing any concern with these measures. So we were very relieved, actually, to see these results in this first study. Would they do the risk assessment again? And what we found was virtually all of them would. The controls maybe a little less so, the controls here being the group that was not disclosed their genetic risk. But you'll see that there was high interest in this. And they were willing to pay for it. This was a question, and they were asked this question after having obtained it. So they were all willing to pay $100 to $500 for this information. What about their health behavior changes? Did they make any changes in their vitamins, which really means supplements, exercise, and their medications? It turns out that the E4 positive group made a lot of changes. And they did this even though they were told that there were no prevention or anything that would cure them, but they still, you know, did these things. And the E4 negative group and the non-disclosed group were similar. That was at 1 year. At 6 weeks, similar types of information about nutrition and supplements. So any nutritional change, the E4 positive group were more likely to make change, and that was especially true of supplements. What about insurance changes? Well, clearly, long-term care insurance, I don't know if you have such things in Europe, but in the US, it's a big deal. So you could see that the E4 positive individuals were much more likely to go out and get long-term care insurance because they might be become demented and need care for a long time. They also made some increases in their health insurance and lowered their life insurance. So that was basically the first trial. In the second trial, we asked a little bit about dosing the exposure, and we provided the same protocol that we did in the first trial. That was called the extended protocol. And then we also did a condensed protocol, which was abbreviated, to see if it would make a difference. So in this one, we had 357 subjects, 120 had the extended protocol, 232 had the condensed. In the condensed protocol, they received pre-education questionnaire and a medical history. They received that in the mail. They filled it out, sent it in. They received some brochures for their education. This is how it differed from the extended protocol. And when it came to disclosure, they all received APOE disclosure information. When they came to that, they just participated in a question and answer session, unlike the much more detailed contact with a genetic counselor in the extended protocol. And again, these subjects were followed up to a year. This was a non-inferiority trial, and you can see here that if we looked at tests related distress among those who are E4 negative versus those who are E4 positive, the condensed protocol was not inferior to the extended protocol, so it seemed to work. What about adding information on CBD risk, so diluting the potential risk information? In this one, we had 344 people, 154 with educational brochure and informed consent, 138 with informed consent, all the same thing, actually. The difference was in the disclosure itself. So for those who received the AD risk only, they received the same information we were seeing before in the first trial. But in the second one, we added a little bit about the CBD risk given you have an APOE4 allele. And it was really just a very simple statement that if you have a 4 allele, it puts you at greater risk of CBD. Nothing, no risk curves, nothing like that, just a very simple statement. And again, these people were followed up for a year. So what happened with exercise? Well, the E4 positive group were more active than the E4 negative group. And you see that the people who received the CBD information, the yellow, were even more so. So it's interesting how they respond. In terms of this test-related distress, the AD-only group, the E4 positives, had somewhat more distress than the E4 negative group. But interestingly enough, the E4 positives who were had the CBD risk as additionally were at lower risk than the group that received the AD information only. So this was a significant interaction, a difference in response. What about their comprehension? Well, at 6 weeks, there was correct within a small range estimate of the lifetime risk, about 60%, at 12 months, about 50%. In terms of their genotype, around 2/3 of the subjects remembered at six weeks and 12 months. So, what happens to those who learn their genetic risk? Safety. There were no long-term concerns in terms of anxiety and depression or test-related distress, so we felt that it was safe to provide this information. What about lifestyle changes? Well, we already noted that there were changes in diet, exercise, medications, and those at higher risk, APOE4 positive, were 2.7 times more likely to make any of these changes, even though they were told that there was no prevention or cure. There were definitely insurance changes for those who were E4 positive, increasing their long-term care insurance and their health insurance. Adding information on risk of CVD lowered the distress among the APOE4 positive individuals. I don't know why. At 12 months, half remembered their lifetime risk and about two-thirds remembered their genotype. Genetic data are now available and safe to communicate. There's a lot of genetic data. We've talked about it today. 20 years ago, you were unlikely to receive genetic information except for rare monogenic illnesses. Today, there is a lot of information available, and people are beginning to go after it. Some are just curious. They go to 23andMe or other organizations to get this information. It's unclear how this information may improve health, especially for multiple gene diseases, such as coronary heart diseases. So the example I was giving, it was only a single gene, but if you have many genes that are putting you at risk to disease and you compute a polygenic risk score, David's going to tell you all about that. I am unclear how you would deal with that in communicating that information to people. But I do predict that such information will gradually make its way into your clinical record. And that's the end.